Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate you showing up. So, I've been MIA for the last couple weeks because I've been sick as a dog. Like, I haven't been this sick in so long. It was just such a long, prolonged experience. Like, I started feeling it like 2.5 weeks ago on a Tuesday. And yesterday was the first day I started seriously feeling like myself again. Like, I woke up in bed and everything hurt so bad that my teeth hurt. Like my jaw hurt. Like, I'm sure I had a fever. And just this huge, immense amount of fucking mucus. I'm sorry, I know that's just probably gross to hear about. I know a lot of people don't like to think about snot, but I'm finally getting back to normal, and I'm just grateful to be here. So I was just sitting in bed reading, and I realized I hadn't recorded in a long time. Like, I haven't even thought about it. Like, being sick in itself is such an altered state of consciousness from ordinary, waking, sober, normal mind brain. Like, I'm usually pretty sharp. Like, I feel like I'm usually like a pretty sharp tool. Like, I can distinguish and notice things and think clearly most of the time, despite my marijuana use. And I just felt dull. It reminded me of drinking alcohol, which is one of the biggest reasons why I don't like to drink alcohol anymore, is that I don't like that dull feeling, that sedated feeling. But because of the sedation, a lot of the extenuating thought processes that I was used to propagating were kind of let down and pushed away just because there wasn't enough energy to pass around all those little guys. And just coming back into my power, my vitality, just I'm really ready to get back into it. Another thing that I did recently, which I actually found quite challenging, was I stopped consuming edible marijuana, which was hard. So THC, when we eat THC, it gets converted into another type of cannabinoid that is stronger than THC on its own. And for the past 6 years, I've been consuming between 100 and 200 milligrams of edible THC every night for sleep. In fact, I've been smoking marijuana for sleep since I was 12 years old. I haven't fallen asleep sober since. I've woken up in the middle of the night, which is something that I found trying since I've stopped consuming marijuana, is that I have no ability to sleep through the night anymore. And I'll wake up for periods of time and it'll be very disconcerting. And I'll find myself very anxious, worrying about if I'll go back to bed, and I always do. But it happens so many times throughout the night that there's this continuity of moments where it feels like I didn't sleep at all, but I did. Most of the time, I'm usually only awake for maybe 10 minutes. You know, so I sleep hours between that, but the sleep cycles are fucked. And so I'd really like to put some awareness out there to this situation when it comes to sedating ourselves to sleep. There's a lot of different ways to do it. The most legal routes would be things like melatonin. And I know some people who use melatonin with their children, and not trying to be judgmental, but I would caution you to seriously consider how this could be affecting sleep cycles. I've been playing around with this theory with myself that any act of trying to jimmy the lock or to push ourselves into sleep without our own willpower, I feel, is deleterious and causes damage to the whole system. And I've been doing this to myself for almost 2/3 of my life at this point. Alcohol would be the next most legally consumable sedative that we could use for sleep. And I've even been thinking, like, really, really hardly on the healthier sedatives that I've pushed in the past. The things that I use, like valerian root or like catnip can be helpful. Mugwort, there's all these herbs that can be used for sleep too. But since I've stopped consuming edibles and since I've tried to hack it again, now that I've had this withdrawal of sorts, even the valerian root and the things that I thought were really light, you know, I think that's part of the reason why I'm waking up throughout the night is because I don't have this muscle built to be able to go into this. And then there's another component to this falling asleep consciousness. In the moment when we're falling asleep, things can get weird. You know, that's where dreams come about. And I've been dreaming more than I ever have in my entire life. And I know that I'm going to be dreaming more the more I can try to start falling asleep sober. But in that moment when we're falling asleep, it's almost hallucinatory. There's something very special about that in-between space when we're going out of consciousness. Because in those deep sleep cycles outside of the dream, we're completely not there. We've left the place. We're not in it anymore, you know? Like, and our loose ability to recall even the dream cycle is also bound up in this ability to remember it. And that requires some sort of sensitivity. And so I feel that the sedatives, you know, when we push ourselves into dozing off or passing out, which was my preferred access into sleep, I didn't want to know about it. I wanted to literally just wake up the next morning and like, that was okay for me for so long, just to know that I skipped it. It was mu much more what I was trying to do was just hit the skip button, you know? And I want to foster this part of my life. I spend half of my life, or maybe not half, about a third of my life, sometimes less, a third to a quarter of my life in this space of consciousness and the sleep consciousness. And I have completely underdeveloped it. I have no access to it, and I've been skipping it for so long, you know? And I think that that's also bound up in a lot of other attributes in waking consciousness. And I think that's also going to be psychosomatically bound up in our physical health too. And how good we sleep and the quality of our sleep and how we do that sleeping is going to be bound up in how we feel when we're awake. I know that, and I know that's got to be validated somewhere empirically. It's a scientific way, you know? So there's this hallucinatory effect when we're falling asleep, you know? And in that little space is this daydreaming element that I've been really, really transfixed by. And I don't have to be falling asleep either. Sometimes it can happen when I'm meditating. And in Zen, they call it moksha, which is illusion. But I still find it captivating because it might be illusionary, but it's indicative to my underconsciousness and the things that I don't get to hold all the time. So for me, it's some of the most valuable information I could get is these little weird bits that seep up to the surface in these in-between spaces of consciousness. And we're going from one to the other. There's so many different places we could reside or find ourselves in. There's a myriad of worlds in you. There's a myriad of places that you can find in you, and a lot of stuff that you've never seen about you. And that's amazing to me, right? So, another way that I've seen these altered states is, of course, in my favorite tool, the hallucinogens, the serotonergic compounds. Yesterday, I took about 0.7 grams of this remarkable albino strain of psilocybic mushrooms called albedo that were grown by a very close friend of mine that's doing a fantastic job. And these guys are beautiful. They're chunky. Albedo has to be some sort of penis envy variant, I swear, because it has that very penile quality to it. But it was so strong. And it just took me away. Like, I didn't even have to worry about the come up. As soon as it started to reach my brain and into my, seep into my consciousness. And I sat there in my bed for a solid 2 hours with no music, just daydreaming, you know, and I was visibly awake. I was looking around at things, but just in between my closed eyelids, whenever I'd blink, I would go to this other space for a fraction of a second, but that fraction of a second would be dilated to be so much larger. And that's where that dreamlike quality of it comes in that I'm analyzing, you know, because it's the same thing when you're waking up rapidly before getting up. Like, you know, if you'll fall into deeper cycles earlier in the night, and then by the end of the night of your sleep cycles, you can start to wake up frequently, you know, like every 20 minutes. And in between all those 20 minute little sleeps, you'll have these intense, vivid dreams that can have a lot of narrative potential that might even stretch outside of a 20 minute quality. And in reality, the REM sleep might have been like a minute, you know? And so it's like, it's the same thing under this serotonergic influence. When this facilitation of mindset has come, then we can find that same space within us that I would call the daydreaming area. And it's cool to do it while awake. And it gives me familiarity with the feeling because they are related, you know? And so what interests me so much more nowadays, because I've known and I've been able to facilitate these experiences with myself for several years, and I've talked to other people who do similar things, so I know it's a thing. It's not just my own little echo chamber of thought. But besides that, there's this ability to do it without substances. And this is where I go back to Andrew Weil, who I was discussing a couple weeks ago on my last episode that I was able to put out. His idea of this active placebo. So what's the definition of a placebo, guys? A placebo is like a sugar pill, right? It's this thing that's inert, that doesn't have any physiological or medicinal quality to it. But when you give it to a sick person, it elucidates a response where the sick person is healed. And if it's just a sugar pill, who's doing the healing? The patient. There's something inside the person that has the capacity to bring about this response, even to a sugar pill. Where we live in this society where we're all told that we all have issues, we all have problems, we're insecure from childhood because of this strict individualism. And when we grow up and we feel that insecurity, we're told to take a pill for it. And when that insecurity makes it hard to sleep, we're told to take a pill for it. And when it makes us sad, we're told to take a pill for it. We're told that all these physiological things that we can take, those are the keys to changing us. Which they might be. There's some truth to that. In hallucinogens, there's a lot of noise beyond just this connection to that joy state and that connection to everything. Beyond that, there's also, you know, cold feelings, and there's all these physical responses, increased heart rate. You can have fear. There's all this noise that's attached to this desired thing, right? Those are aspects of the drug. But that state of consciousness that's meditative, that altered state can be acquired without substances, because in the Weilian idea, the connection to that other place of mind is purely placebo. These things are facilitative. So while in normal consciousness, how can we use our nervous system and use our thoughts to incur change? This is power, you know? Monks have been seen on, like, they use some sort of like temperature readings and probes, but they can cause temperature changes from the left side of their body to the right, like in their hands. They can be in such a difference as almost like 15 degrees, like they can make body parts cold just using thought, by thinking it through self control and sensitivity to this thing that we're all in, being it, experience. Outside of the ego drivel of judgment about it, unquote, right? So this has just been buried in my mind, you know, and I've been working really hard to do that. So one of the things that I have been doing for several years is I'll microdose small amounts of LSD at work, you know, like not a lot. Like sometimes I do a little bit too much, but like usually it's like a less than a quarter of a hit of acid. And typically, even with a strong amount, it's not a large dose, and it facilitates that state where I'm not bored, where I'm very interested and connected with my work. It's very much part of this joy state that I am fascinated by, this workflow, when we can be completely involved in what we're doing. And I've done this for so long, and I deluded myself into thinking that those good days were responsible by the acid. And then the day after, sometimes I would double down in my boredom because I had convinced myself that without this substance, I was going to be bored. But that's a lie. That state of workflow and joy is completely open to me at any point in time. All I have to do is grab it and be involved in what I'm doing. I just have to shut off my brain for a little bit to do that. Not my brain, but the part of my brain that compiler, the manipulator, the taskmaster, the ego. If I can shut that down for a little bit, I can be completely involved in what I'm doing, and that's blissful. And that's a lot of the value in a lot of these substances. And that's a lot of the value in meditative practice, because we get so sensitive to our breath, and we can just be completely internal and comfortable with it. There's an aspect of that that is part of doing it externally too, with our work, with our karma. But last week, after my microdose day, I was convinced that I was going to find the exact same work state that I had been in the day before. And part of that work state I found in myself is an incredible compassion towards my coworkers. And even with people that typically irritate me or confuse me, or I have convinced myself that I am judgmental enough of how they do things that they're an other, right? But within a team, you can put that down for a little bit, and when you work with somebody wholly, there's this compassion, this softness that comes. And I really enjoy working with people. And so this person I've had difficulties with because of their own temperament and their own mentality, you know, when I take a little bit of LSD, I can usually put all that down and just be completely loving and involved with them. And it always benefits both of us, you know, it benefits the relationship. But I went to work sober the next day, and I wanted so badly just to maintain that by myself and to have that knowledge that I could do it by myself without a material tool, without a material reason for why I'm doing it, but just having the fuel source being my own internal will. And surprisingly, I had a wonderful day, and I was so involved with my work, even though I was sober. I was able to tap into that place in me that is so not bored with reality, because reality is just so lovely. And that's what I wanted to share this week. I'm convinced that aspect of involvement, of beingness, I know I'm just saying the same words over and over again, but I think everybody has it. I think you have that in you. You have an immense peace and joy. And you can bring it into your world, and it can seriously be so different than all the panic and struggle that we lap on our shoulders. You know, to bring up the Nietzschean camel, we got this bag on our backs, and we just keep putting shit in it. And all that shit is just judgments. It's just ideas on how things ought to be. When we can never change how things are, there is no ought to be. So I would encourage us to take some of that shit out of our backpacks and just to be involved with the loveliness of being in our life. So that's my message for this week. I hope you can find something relatable in that. My purpose here on this show is to be a source of help. I want to be a friend. I want to be a compatriot. I want to be somebody that you can talk to and relate to. And if you would like to email me and discuss anything that's going on in your life, you can email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. That's also in the show notes. If you'd like to just copy and paste that, because it's pretty long. But we can talk about anything you want. I'm here for you, primarily. This isn't me just trying to be on my soapbox. If you have any ideas on what things that you'd like me to investigate or to cover, I can look into other things. I'm always reading different material. I'm reading a scientific book on the evolution of sex right now. And it has nothing to do with humans. It's like bed bugs. So here's like a fucked up one. So bed bugs have this like massive genital. Like the males, they have these massive like sword-like, like they're not soft, they're like hard carapace things. And they don't even look for the female bed bugs' vaginas. They literally just stab them into their abdomen and then splooge on the inside of these things' bodies. And then the sperm like travels through the fucking like circulatory system and then finds the eggs somehow. Which is just fucking nuts. It's so metal. Like, good Lord. But I'm always just reading just something from some weird direction is my point in bringing that up. So if you want me to read a book for you or look through some ideas that you don't have time to, that's what I'm here for. So let's keep moving forward together and let's keep learning how to be more comfortable in our skins. And let's try to sleep better too. Let's seriously think about our sleep patterns. I'm going to go find a book and then we'll see what Odin's doing and then I'll let you go for this week. Thank you for being here. I'm always going to appreciate it. This is from Ram Dass, Paths to God. It's his book where he goes through the Bhagavad Gita, and I found it very educational for me to understand a lot of these principles. This is just one section, so you get a piece of the flavor of this man's thoughts. So here goes. Asteya, which is non-stealing, is obvious. If everybody's us, who are you going to steal from? Are you going to rip yourself off? Are you going to steal out of the cookie jar at home? You're just taking it from yourself. When there's no them in your universe, you can't steal. It's that simple. So in order to steal, you have to see your victim as other. That means stealing takes us deeper into the illusion of me and you, which is the illusion of identity, which is the illusion of separation. That, from a spiritual point of view, is why non-stealing is part of the practice of Ashtanga Yoga. It's not because of our usual ideas about morality. It's because in order to steal, we have to turn the other person into them, which rules out our seeing them as us. That takes us away from the one. It's just that straightforward. When you come to a place where you're absolutely clean in your relationships with other people, you start to recognize what fun it is not to be feeling paranoid all the time. There's such a sense of freedom in it. You see that you really don't want to create all the stuff that comes from getting into relationships with other people that have elements of dishonesty in them. It's like the difference in the feeling you have coming across a border carrying dope and then coming across the border not carrying dope. Because of my nefarious psychedelic past, I was on the list for a long time. And so when the custom agents would punch in my name at the border, lights would flash and bells would ring and the agents would make hurried phone calls because I really was a bad guy. See? Then they proceed to go through everything I was carrying. They look inside my sneakers and turn all the pant pockets inside out, and I just sit there doing mantra and enjoying the whole scene. I was watching a good public servant doing their work. After a while, they notice I wasn't buying into the whole paranoia that their scene usually creates, and we generally end up being really loving buddies. It would take about 2 hours, but that's okay. You just have to learn to move slowly. After all, it's always just Maharaj coming to put us on. So to avoid separating ourselves from other people, we stop ripping them off. We practice asteya. And while I think that most of us have already renounced stealing in its most literal, obvious form, the practice of asteya and Ashtanga Yoga goes much deeper than that. It's a much subtler piece. It's not just the physical stuff, like not stealing somebody's wallet. Practicing asteya includes things like not accepting undeserved praise and not taking credit for somebody else's idea. It means that in the very broadest sense, possibly, that you don't appropriate anything, material or otherwise, that isn't rightfully yours. That's asteya.
Hello, it's Ask O again.
Whoa.
Oh, that's C.
What? What are you doing? Nobody can see you.
I know. I know that.
This is audio.
I know that.
You gotta talk out loud and describe what you think.
I know that. I forgot.
Okay. This has been fun.
None.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.